All right. Sorry, I was just reading a review someone left of our last podcast. Hello and welcome to the We're Not Experts History Podcast. My name's James and with me, as usual, is Sarah. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
And today it's Sarah's turn to...
It's my turn today.
Yeah.
Well, this one, this one could potentially be fun, and I have deliberately not... Go on, you're going to interrupt me. Well, that's kind of what makes it fun. I've deliberately not mentioned anything to you because this time it's going to be a little bit different to what we normally do.
Okay.
Basically, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you two scenarios, historical related scenarios. One of them will be true. One of them will be completely made up. And you have to try to guess which is true and which is false.
I see.
So, yeah, let's see how you do. I mean, to be honest, I can imagine that you're going to do quite well at this because you seem to know everything. But let's see. Let's see. But so are you ready for a game of true or false?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. So the first one relates to Napoleon. And this is story one. So 1807, Napoleon has just signed the Treaty of Tilsit with Russia. And to celebrate, he organises a rabbit hunt for himself and his officers. So they line up, they have the guns ready, they're expecting a glorious day of sport. But when the cages are opened, the hundreds of rabbits, they don't run away. They actually run toward Napoleon and his officers. They literally charge them. And as it turns out, these weren't wild rabbits. These were actually farm-raised and they were bred for eating. So all I can think is that they've seen the men in uniform and they thought, oh, food.
Yeah.
And that's why they've run towards them. So, yeah, the... mighty Emperor of France was literally chased off the field by bunnies. And apparently some officers did try to shoot them, but their guns jammed when the rabbits knocked them over. So
superb.
It was carnage. So yeah, did that happen or did it not happen? I'll let you think about that one. The next story, also related to Napoleon, is... another one of Napoleon's strategies. I can never say this word. Strategies. Did I say that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I can't say that word fast. I get all tongue-tied. Anyway.
Strategies.
I'm not going to say it again. He supposedly attempted to train seagulls to deliver military messages across the English Channel. And the plan was to teach the birds to carry sealed notes to French troops that were stationed along the coast. And it almost worked because seagulls are actually quite intelligent, but they kept getting distracted by the smell of the fish market. So they were just flying back towards the fish market. And the project was abandoned because, the birds just kept flying backwards. Which do you think is more ridiculous, the rabbits chasing Napoleon or
the sad thing is I know Napoleon hated rabbits, he was scared of rabbits, and that first one is true, he ran away from the rabbits.
You are correct, it was the rabbits. This actually happened in 1807, and there are accounts that describe Napoleon initially laughing, finding it quite amusing, but then panicking when the rabbits were trying to climb into his boots. And they had to, kind of whisk him away from the scene before he lost his stuff. I almost swore then. Yeah. That was actually true. Oh, and I have to say... this probably goes without saying, but I'm going to say it. No, yeah. Google. You are not to be Googling anything while I'm talking.
I do not have access to Google whilst we're doing this, but sadly I've heard that story on a radio program.
Okay, fair enough. That's the thing. You listen to too much radio, so you probably will have heard most of these. Yeah. But anyway.
I will add, there was a prisoner of war during the Second World War who jokingly told a German guard that the British were crossbreeding pigeons with parrots so they could tell the resulting bird the secret, whatever they needed to, whatever news they needed to share, and they would let that go. And obviously the German guard passes this on as a fact, not realizing the bloke's joking. And when the German authorities realized the prisoner was making fun of the guard, I think they gave him a bit of solitary confinement.
Almost sounds believable, though. Almost.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, the stereotype about the Germans not having a sense of humour, that makes that look quite clear there.
Yeah. Do you know what? That actually, you saying that, I imagine you've watched Monty Python. Please tell me you have.
I love Monty Python's Flying Circus.
The joke that killed everybody. Do you remember that?
Yes, yeah.
And do you remember when the Germans tried to retaliate with their own joke and it just wasn't cutting it?
My dog's no nose. Yeah.
Yeah, funny. But I feel like I need to go and watch that again. It's hilarious. Anyway, we go on to pair two. So this is part two. And we're talking about animals in history. So I have two stories to share. So the first one. In the 18th century, a fisherman in Cornwall caught a lobster that had escaped the boiling pot twice. Caught a lobster, put it in the pot, it escaped, and the local market was astonished when they put it back in the pot and it escaped again. And news of this indestructible lobster actually spread through the town and it became something of a local celebrity and people actually came to see it. I think I've said actually too many times. Marvelling at how an animal could survive what would normally be certain death. And it did eventually meet its fate, but the story became a legend among fishermen and was celebrated in letters and tavern tales. So that's story number one. Story number two is another legend, or it could potentially be real. During a minor skirmish in Gascony in 1367, a particularly brave donkey carried supplies straight through enemy lines without flinching, and the local lord was so impressed that he supposedly knighted it on the spot, dubbing it Sir Donkey of Gascony. And they say it even had a little coat of arms sewn onto its saddle to mark its rank. So, yeah, one of those two. What do you think?
Ring a bell. So whichever one's true, I've never heard before.
Okay.
But I'm going to say B. I'm going to say it's the donkey.
You think that the donkey was knighted?
I'm not entirely sure a lobster getting out of a pot is newsworthy enough to attract a crowd.
You would think...
people are daft enough to knight a donkey.
Yeah, you would think, but it was actually the lobster. The lobster, escape the boiling pot twice. And yes, it did become a national or a local celebrity. And the donkey, that was totally made up. That never happened. So I got you.
Never heard of it either way.
So lobsters were actually considered a luxury food in some areas, but in a lot of areas, maybe when they were in sort of surplus, they would be fed to prisoners or servants. So a lobster twice escaping would have been quite a big deal. Not to us now, but yeah. So it was actually a big deal at the time.
How easily entertain people are they? Those are the sort of people who watch ITV nowadays.
Hmm. Yeah, which is not me. Or listen to our podcast.
Or okay. listen to this rubbish.
Yeah. Okay, so now we have two more stories relating to fashion. So the first one, the first one is we're going back a few centuries in Elizabethan times. Now we have touched on this subject when we did a podcast about ridiculous fashions, and we talked about the big lace collars, the ruffs that were very famous in Elizabethan times. And some were so wide, they actually stretched about a foot from the neck, which meant that at dinner, people had trouble reaching their mouths. And to counteract this, courtiers were given foot-long spoons, which were designed to reach past the lace to deliver the food. And in extreme cases, people had to actually wear little, they were like stilts under the ruffs to keep the collars balanced while they ate.
Oh dear.
So a fashion statement and a workout all in one.
I'm wearing one as we speak.
Yeah, I thought you might be. So did that happen or did this happen? This is the other alternative. We're going forward in time now to the mid-19th century when women or fashion demanded that women wore the big hooped skirts called crinolines or crinolines. Which is it? Is it crinolines? Crinolines?
I think it's crinoline.
Crinoline. Crinoline sounds right to me. So they looked very glamorous. Obviously, the skirts were so wide you could barely fit through the doorway. But they were very, very flammable. And if you brushed too close to an open flame... a candle or a fireplace, obviously this is before electricity, so there are lots and lots of open flames knocking about, the whole skirt could just go up in seconds. And newspapers reported hundreds of deaths across Europe and America. And one story from 1863 tells of a young woman in Boston whose skirt caught fire at a party. And within minutes, several others were also in flames because obviously the skirts are so wide, they're all brushing against each other. And doctors and fire brigades did warn women about this, but the crinolines did stay popular for years. So high fashion, but highly flammable fashion.
Yeah.
Now, which one of those did I make up?
Well, the thing is, I think they might, but is this a trick one? They might both be true, but the one about the long spoons tells me that you haven't got a great memory because I told you about those long spoons.
You did.
Yeah.
But you did.
Is it apocryphal?
What one do you think is true? What one?
I think it's the first one, unless I've told you a myth. I'm going with the long spoons.
So you think the long spoons is true?
Yeah.
You're wrong.
The long spoons. I'm sure I told you about
you
that.
Did. You I did. I and I kept this about. In to trick you yeah. because I thought he's going to think it's the long spoons, but the long spoons, it was a myth. The crinolines really were deadly. And there are reports to suggest that thousands of women actually died in crinoline fires during the 1800s. Oh God, swallowed air. The spoon fed rough idea that's completely made up. It does sound legit, and there are, kind of rumors, if you like, that actually happened, but there's no actual documented evidence to suggest that really did happen. Yes. So
I quite like having a myth exposed, to be honest. Yes. I quite enjoyed that.
But yeah, so that's an interesting one. I thought that might catch you out because I knew you'd go for the spoon one because I thought he told me about that.
I'm now wondering where I've heard that.
The spoon, you told me you heard it on QI.
I wonder if it was on QI or on The Unbelievable Truth on Radio 4.
I'm sure at the time you said it was on QI.
It may very well have been.
But that's just what I remember. But I could be wrong.
Yeah, okay. I do watch a lot of QI. And they've let me down.
You have to go write to them and tell them off and go, I've just been publicly, shamefully embarrassed on a podcast because I thought people ate with big spoons and they didn't.
You say that, but bear in mind which one of us will edit this.
Yeah, don't edit that out. That's just, no, keep that in there. I want you to be ashamed.
You might find when this goes out, I got that one right.
Yeah. All right, then. Anyway, before I take away your editing privileges. I should keep a tally. Right, I'm going to keep a tally.
I'll take one down. Don't worry, I'm keeping a tally.
No, I don't trust you. I'm going to keep a tally.
Sorry, just for the edit. I'm 3-0 up.
Yeah. I am keeping a tally because you are not to be trusted because you're a bloke. Right. Okay, what am I doing? So, part one, that was, you got that right, and part two...
Tony and the Rabbit, I got part two and part three wrong.
Yes, you did. Aha. Okay, so, part four.
Every time you go on to me about knowing everything, I've now proven that is wrong. I don't know, hear it again.
All right, I won't say anymore. Okay. Now we go on to strange jobs. Now, I'm going to tell you about two jobs that may or may not have existed, and you have to tell me which is true and which is false. So, the first one.
Yes.
The knocker-upper. So, before alarm clocks became affordable, British towns had quite an unusual profession that existed, and it was the knocker-upper. And these were people that walked the streets in the early hours carrying long poles, and they would... what would they do? They would tap on windows. Yes, so you've heard this one. But is it a myth? Again, see, you don't know. And to wake workers in time for their shifts. Now, I don't know who would wake the knocker-uppers up, because somebody obviously had to wake them up for them to wake, but unless they just didn't sleep, I don't know. Anyway, so it wasn't just factory workers that relied on this. People like mill workers, dock labourers, bakers, people that had to be up early before alarm clocks, particularly in the winter hours when you wouldn't necessarily be woken by the sun, when you had to be up before sunrise, I mean. And some knocker-uppers, they were so precise that they actually knew which windows belonged to which families, and they would stand outside and wait to see movement, so they knew that the person was up before they moved on to the next house. And one famous knocker-upper in Manchester, he used a pea shooter, and he would fire dried peas at the windows of heavier sleepers. And these worked well into the 1920s, and in some towns even later. So imagine that you have to pay somebody to wake you up every morning because you can't get up.
Yeah, I'm looking
at that. Choose your phone, isn't it? You got an alarm on your phone, just use that. Yeah. Anyway,
well, I imagine that's another knocker.
Clearly, probably. Yeah, they must have had iPhones. Anyway, another potential mythical or true job that existed was a candle watcher. So they were generally employed in the more wealthy households. So this was before gas lighting, and candles were used for light, but they were also a status symbol in the wealthier households. And there was a job called the candle watcher, and their duty was to stand in the dining room or the ballroom, wherever the candles were, and they had to keep an eye on the wax. And if the candle began to drip unevenly, the candle watcher would trim the wick and adjust the flame, or even swap the candle out to make sure that the display looked perfect. And the role was actually taken very seriously. And according to one account, an uneven candle could be seen, or was seen, as a terrible embarrassment to the host. And one house in Bath, they allegedly had three candle watchers stationed during a dinner party just to make sure that the wax on the table candles fell gracefully. So what would you rather do, or what do you think is more believable, paying somebody to wake you up or paying somebody to watch your candles to make sure they burned properly?
I wouldn't pay anyone to do either of those things, but I'm pretty... Oh, no. You see, that last one's now got me, because I was particularly sure that the knocker-upper existed, because I had heard the story about the pea shooter. And I'm sure there are photos of people with long sticks tapping on windows in London. So I'm going to say the knocker-upper was real.
Okay. You would be correct. Yes. Oh. The second one was completely fabricated by myself, but yes, the knocker upper. And to be honest, I would have been surprised if you didn't get that one. I did try to make the candle one make sound quite believable, just to kind of, you know, put you off a bit. But yes,
once again, I started wondering if it was a myth.
Most historians worth their salt, or most researchers, would have heard of a knocker upper as a role. So I would have been quite surprised if you didn't get that one right. But they knocker uppers, that as crazy as it sounds, that was actually a real thing, and they were still around in towns even past the 1920s, because although alarm clocks would have existed, not everybody could buy one, and it may have been cheaper to pay somebody to come and wake you up every morning as opposed to buying an alarm clock, which is crazy to think about. And it actually makes me think about how technology, I mean, even today we see it, you know, with AI and all of this stuff coming in and all these automatic things, how technology would have killed a lot of jobs for people. But, you know, it wouldn't happen overnight. It would have been a gradual thing. It wouldn't have just all of a sudden.
The electric light bulb killed off the candle watching trade.
Which never existed in the first place. So,
Which never existed in the first place, yeah.
But it would have killed off the lamplighter's trade, because nobody had to go and light the gas lamps because they didn't have any. I guess as well, I mean, the knocker-uppers, like, it sounds a bit crazy, but then when you think about it, I mean, I've never done this, because whenever I've travelled for pleasure rather than for business. But people that travel for business, when they do need to be up at a certain time, again, I don't know why you can't just use your phone alarm, but you can actually get the hotel to give you a wake-up call. So you make sure you're up for your meetings and things. That said, I do kind of get it, because if I have to be somewhere, so if I've got a meeting, or, you know, I've got an appointment or somewhere I need to be and I need to be up at a certain time, I'll set my alarm, but I will generally get my husband to set his alarm as well, because I don't trust that mine will go off. Even though it's never let me down, I always say to my husband, right, can you set yours as well, just in case mine doesn't go off? And then they both go off at the same time and just blast us while we're asleep. But anyway, so yeah, that is you got that one right. So well done, you.
Too well.
Yes. Well, okay. Part five. Odd wars.
Right.
We're talking about odd wars that may or may not have happened. One of them did happen. One of them didn't. So. The first one, there's a legend, or it could be a truth, that in Ontario, moose herds began to raid the turnip fields, and they were literally trampling the fences, eating the crops. So the farmers allegedly teamed up with the military with rifles and farm tools in an attempt to defend their land. Now, this sounds very similar to another story that we talked about, that Emu was. So it was a similar situation, except we had moose instead of emus. And moose are big. I mean, I've never seen a moose in real life. I think I'd be very scared if I did. But they are big.
If you imagine how big you think a moose is, it's bigger than that. Mm. I've seen videos and they are huge.
They are big, yeah. They're huge, yeah. So, and this next part doesn't surprise me. The moose supposedly stood their ground, so they weren't scared off by the guns and the farm tools, and they trampled the fields anyway, and the farmers were forced to retreat. So, yeah, it's, I can kind of see it, because you're not going to mess with an angry moose. I mean, they are big. They are big, big, big things. Yeah. So I'm not surprised they retreated. But
every now and then you'll see an image online of a car that's hit one and the moose has run away.
And the car's just absolutely totaled. Yeah.
It's just a huge amount of muscle.
Well, they're bigger than horse. I mean, you know, you hit a horse with a car and you're going to write your car off. Yeah. A moose is much, much bigger than a horse. But so that was story number one. Did that happen? Did it not happen? Who knows? Right, the next one. In the 19th century, so it's a similar situation. This was in Wales, and the farmers in the Welsh farmers faced a relentless enemy, rabbits. Now, as you know, rabbits reproduce at an astonishing rate, and they were destroying the crops and devastating the fields. And the farmers tried everything. You know, they've tried traps, fences, dogs, but the rabbits just kept coming. So they eventually, a bit like the moose situation, teamed up with the military. And, well, they were volunteers, sort of military-style volunteers. No, definitely not Napoleon. And, yeah, the reports at the time claimed that, or described the rabbits as almost an army overwhelming the land. And the rabbit plague caused serious economic damage. And to be honest, the rabbits won because although they developed new strategies for pest control, the rabbits just kept bouncing back. So it was one of the most frustrating wars between humans and wildlife in history. Now, did that happen? Do you think? Human versus rabbit or human versus moose?
Obviously, whichever one it is, I've not heard of it before, so I'm going to have to guess. Do I think Ontario went to war with the moose? I think the moose would spend more time in the forest avoiding people as much as possible, as obviously rabbits get out. But I'm going to go with the rabbits, the Welsh rabbits.
Welsh rabbits.
The Welsh rabbits. I think the Welsh farmers went to war with the rabbits and were outnumbered, and then outnumbered even more. I think it's B.
You would be correct. That did happen. So you are 1, 2, 3. You are 3 out of 5. You are correct. So you're winning.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah, 3-2 up now.
So we have 5 more to go. So let's see how you do. So we're halfway through and you are winning. I say winning. It's not really against anything. It's just, you're winning.
I'll take a draw.
You're winning. But honestly, as crazy as it sounds, rabbits were a massive agricultural pest in the UK. They still are.
Not only the UK, yeah.
Everywhere, but particularly as this happened in the UK. And do you know what? It's not funny, really. It's awful. But we went, a couple of years ago, we went to Yorkshire and we stayed in the absolute back end of nowhere. And I had this fantasy that we would be strolling around the fields, going out for picnics every day. Because I love going for picnics, but I get very put off because a lot of our local parks, not knocking them, but they're very messy, as in people take their dogs there and people let their dogs do things and they don't clean up, okay? It's just a fact. And I was really looking forward. I thought, oh, that far out in the countryside, you're not going to have people walking their dogs. You're not going to have that to deal with. Oh, we can, you know, have picnics. So, true enough, didn't come across any dogs' business. But everywhere, there were dead rabbits. Yeah. Everywhere. Because the farmers used to just go out and shoot them en masse. You'd see them walking around with their shotguns and you'd hear the shotguns going off at various times, normally in the evening time, I guess, when the rabbits would come out. And the fields were just littered with dead rabbits in various stages of decay. And it was disgusting. And I was shocked. That I was just horrified. And yeah, needless to say, we did not have any picnics on that holiday because you could not go within a few yards without finding a rabbit, deceased rabbit.
Yeah.
And I was just not expecting that. So that was a bit of a wake-up call. Anyway, that's slightly off topic, but, well, it's not really off topic. It's kind of related, but...
Yeah.
But anyway, so that happened, and it's still happening. Maybe not with the military involvement, but farmers are still walking around with shotguns shooting rabbits. So, okay. We now move on to medicine. The history of medicine. So,
okay.
Yeah. Now, I have two stories for you as
yeah.
That's just how the... I've lost my train of thought. Right, let me just think for a second. I'm thinking about the dead rabbits and it's putting me off my game. Anyway. Okay. So story number one. This involves chickens. Now, there are historical... This sounds crazy, but, you know, it could be true. There are historical accounts that suggest that Romans, because a lot of our medical beliefs prior to the Industrial Revolution, when we kind of started delving more into the world of medicine and germs and things like that, came from ancient beliefs from the ancient Greeks and the Romans and whatever. So anyway, there are historical accounts that suggest that Romans had quite an unusual cure for hiccups. And one of their methods involved whispering lines of poetry into a chicken's ears. Because farmers and... Now, I'm not suggesting that this worked. This is just what people believed. Farmers and townspeople, they believed that reciting verses from poets could transfer the hiccups to the bird and bring relief to the patient. So can you imagine in Roman times just seeing people just picking chickens up, just whispering to them? So yeah, that was
the thing is, yeah, with that there was someone called Pliny the Elder who used to write down weird cures and things like this, and it's most of the stuff he came up with was absolute crap. I mean, I'm already confused. I haven't even heard the second one.
Okay. Well, that was, and again, I'm not trying to suggest that was a legit cure. It was just something that the Romans believed and actually did. Whether it worked or not, who knows? Next time I've got hiccups, I might try and locate a chicken and whisper to it and see if it gets rid of my hiccups. But anyway, and I will let you know the outcome of that. But anyway.
There is only one medically proven cure for hiccups, and I can't say what it is.
Why? Is it rude?
Because you say this is, we need to look at this as like a family podcast.
Oh, okay, it's rude then. Okay, you can tell me after. Okay.
It's unpleasant, yeah.
Well, this is also quite unpleasant. If this is true, this is very unpleasant. So this was sort of early modern Europe, and we know that medicine and the ideas around medicine could be a little bit grim, and a cure for nosebleeds would be some people, they would actually turn to powdered moss which had been scraped from a human skull And the apothecaries would grind this moss, and it had to be scraped from a human skull as well. That's quite specific. They would bottle it. So they would grind it into a powder, bottle it, and sell it as a cure. I mean, I imagine they may have sold it for a cure to lots of different things, but particularly nosebleeds it was meant to have been a cure for. So this wasn't just based on superstition. People genuinely believed then that death itself gave the moss special healing powers, and the more skulls it came from, the more potent the remedy was considered. So if you've got ground moss that's come from multiple different skulls, it would be more potent. And some believe that the moss from a criminal as opposed to a non-criminal would be more, would be stronger. And back then, this was actually considered a legitimate treatment. And believe it or not, you could buy this skull moss in pharmacies across Europe. So which would you rather do? Would you rather try skull moss, or would you rather whisper poetry to a chicken?
It's hardly a day goes by when I wish I could whisper poetry to a chicken.
I'll bring a chicken round so you can talk to it.
I wasn't sure until you mentioned the moss growing on the basically a skull.
Mm.
And then that rang a bell. So I'm going to go with the moss cure for a nosebleed.
Okay, you think that that actually happened? Or, well, you think that was...
I think people sold moss, ground-up moss that had been growing on the skull of a dead body.
You would be correct. That actually happened. That actually happened. As I said, early modern Europe was full of these somewhat unusual cures, and the chicken poetry was just something I just made up because I thought it sounded funny. I like chickens. Maybe that's what they did. I don't know how... So I know that they could buy the skull moss. I don't know what they did with the skull moss. Maybe it depended on what the ailment was, but particularly for nosebleeds is what it was used for. But yeah, maybe they did snort it. Sounds disgusting, but...
someone's written it down and everyone's believed.
Yes, because obviously medicine in early Europe did rely heavily, because we didn't have the science that we have now. So it did rely heavily on superstition and trial and error and just the most bizarre ingredients that you could imagine. And people use things like powdered mummies, crushed insects, and animal parts, thinking that they would cure certain things. So yeah, bit weird, but, and I can't say that it worked, but clearly people believed it. No, exactly. We weren't there. And again, you know, you don't know how much that it could have been a placebo effect. You know, if you're given something and told this will cure this, you might convince yourself that it has cured you of whatever it is that's ailing you. You don't know. Going back to the moss theory, some pharmacies, they actually claim that the moss had to be stored under a full moon to keep its potency.
Okay.
So that's an extra little thing that I thought I'd just share. That actually happened. They even used to make necklaces out of the moss, and people would wear them to aid them with certain ailments.
Okay.
I just made that up. That didn't happen. Just to like confuse things. But anyway, let's go on to feasts. Feasts and food. Feast. Yes.
Okay.
So, number one. So we're going across to Northern Europe. And we're going to talk about Viking feasts. And Vikings used to drink quite a peculiar drink, and it was called seaweed mead. And it was a honey wine that was supposedly boiled with strands of kelp, which would give it like a briny sort of ocean-like flavour. And according to the legend or the story or the, it was so pungent that only the bravest warriors dared to drink it. So it was kind of like, you know, when we were kids and you'd get the really sour sweets and you'd dare each other to see you could keep it in your mouth the longest before throwing up. It was kind of like that. So this wasn't a pleasant drink. It was kind of like a mark of your manliness if you could drink this mead. Yeah, so it was a drink that would test your courage and your stomach, basically. It wasn't a drink that you would drink for pleasure. So that was one. That's story number one. Now, story number two. Now we're going back to Roman times, Roman banquets. And in Roman times, one of their prized delicacies was a humble dormouse. Now, the dormouse would be fattened in a special jar, clay jar, and it would be fed nuts and chestnuts and honey until it was fat and plump. And once ready, I assume they would have killed the mouse before they did this next bit, but it would be stuffed with more nuts and spices, roasted, and served as an appetizer to the Roman elite. And wealthy citizens actually considered them as a mark of sophistication. So if you could serve a stuffed dormouse at your banquet, it was a way to show off your refinement and your good taste. And they would especially be served at funerals and special feasts. So they were kind of a bit of a status symbol, rather than just a snack. So yes, which do you think is the most doable? Was it the dormice or was it the mead?
Well, I think I'm going to have it written into my will that when I die, I want dormouse served at my funeral.
I'm not coming to your funeral. Sadly, then.
Actually, quite like the sound of that. Quite sadly, I have heard of the dormouse recipe, so I'm going to go with dormouse and hope it's not a myth.
You are correct. It is not a myth. It is true. And the Romans genuinely did enjoy them as a luxurious snack. And the seaweed mead, I just made that up. That didn't happen. It wasn't a real Viking beverage. I mean, I'm not ruling it out. I'm sure there was some experimental longhouse brews going on. But as far as we know, there's nothing in the records to suggest that they actually had seaweed flavoured mead. I just invented that. But yes, the dormice, that was actually a thing. And it was a very popular and refined dish. I mean, one of many. I mean, if you kind of look going through the years, you would have had some really strange foods, which I don't know if they're still in existence, but in Japan, for example, jellyfish was quite a popular dish. And in Northern Europe, I mean, I can't even imagine how disgusting this must have been, but wow, blubber. I mean, no, not good. Couldn't.
Herrings are a delicacy, I believe.
Yeah.
Stulted herring.
Well, talking of birds, in medieval Europe, bird tongues. Birds,
herring, not herons.
Sorry. Yeah, but you're talking about the fish. Okay. Well, yeah. I've diverted slightly then. I'm talking about the birds. But bird tongues were actually a delicacy in medieval Europe. Now, if you think how small a bird's tongue is, I mean, that's crazy. That's, what is that? I'm not even making that up. That's actually a thing. So yes, back in the Roman times, they ate mice. The thought of it makes me feel sick, but
I might try it.
Ugh, disgusting. Ugh, awful. Awful, awful.
You'd have a little bag of them, a few in a bag.
No, awful. Okay, well, you're doing well. You're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So you're five. You've got 5 right out of 7. So you're winning. You're doing good.
I need one more to stay ahead.
Yes. So now we go on to pair number eight, part eight. And we are, or I'm talking about, royal oddities. So obviously we know the royals are an odd bunch, but here are two oddities from history. Quick, edit that bit out. Here are two stories from history relating to kings. One of them's true, one of them I've just made it up. Okay. So the first one, King Charles, talking about the wrong king, King James the First. So King James the First, King Charles is the other story. King James the First of England was not a fan of tobacco. And in 1604, he published a pamphlet in which he described smoking as a loathsome custom, which was hateful to the nose, harmful to the brain, and dangerous to the lungs. We know that's true. So he was arguably the first monarch to officially condemn smoking, warning of its moral, physical, and social dangers. So he was kind of ahead of the game, really, if you think about it. But you can imagine the court's reaction, all the courtiers tiptoeing around the king, stubbing out their pipes before he could spot them smoking. But some historians suggest that his hatred of tobacco more reflected his concern about imports from the colonies, because he disliked any foreign influence creeping into English habits. So it might have been more for that rather than just not liking tobacco. But either way, he made it very clear that puffing was not fit for nobility. So he did not like smoking. I don't think he banned it, but I think he... he just didn't like it very much. And he made his views known. So that was that. So story number two, we're talking about King Charles II. Now, he allegedly banned forks at court. Forks, as in forks that you eat with, because he insisted that they were unmanly. So courtiers were expected to eat with a knife, spoon, and their hands, but not a fork, never a fork. I don't know how you would eat spaghetti without a fork. Do they have spaghetti then? I don't know. But I imagine if they did, he wouldn't have banned them, because there's no way you can eat spaghetti without a fork, without making an absolute hash of it. But yeah, so that was his thing. So we've got James the First disapproving of smoking, and Charles the Second disapproving of forks. Which is it? Which is it? Which is the one that you think is the most ridiculous and not true? Or which one do you think is the least ridiculous and not true? They're both ridiculous, but...
Well, I know I would say that the banning of forks was ridiculous. Now you put it that way, I'm going to say the banning of forks was ridiculous, and that King James the First of England and James the Fifth or Sixth of Scotland.
First.
I'm going to say he wrote saying how disgusting smoking was. So I'm going with him.
You would be wrong. No, I'm joking. You're right. Oh. You're right. I could have kept that going and just like confused you.
He sounds like a sensible bloke.
Yes, smoking was becoming increasingly popular in England, and especially among the wealthy and the court, because I imagine then tobacco would have been very expensive. It wouldn't have been available to the lower classes. So the pamphlet was actually part moral and part health warning and part political statement. That was true. He actually detested smoking. Supposedly he also banned it in royal carriages as well as in court. And I'm saying that I don't actually know if he did ban it in court or if he just made his
if he had the power to ban it anywhere, it was
he probably would have done.
Yeah,
He was a bit of a writer, because I'm sure it was him who wrote Demonology, which was a book about witches, basically, and how to find them and what they did and things like that. I'm sure that was him that wrote that.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. I'll have to look that up. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, you're doing well. I think you're going to win this, even if you get the next two wrong. I think you're still going to win. You're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, you're 6. 6 out of 10 at the very least. So well done. Well done.
I managed to play this.
Okay.
It's new, can I apologise for a fluke?
Well, let's see how you get on with the next. We've got two more to go. So we're moving on to strange sports. So back in the day when people did not have Netflix and iPads and mobile phones to do things on, YouTube and whatever, they had to make their own entertainment. Yeah, basically when we were born. That's mad, isn't it? I can't...
It's not that long ago.
No, it isn't. It isn't. So I'm going a little bit further back than this. So the first story, we're going back to medieval England, and there was a sport that was known as mob football. So not football as we know it today. That didn't come until much later. But this was mob football. And yes, it was described as sport, but really it was chaos. Entire villages could participate in mob football, and there were no set number of players. There was no defined field, and there were no rules. It was the object of the game was to get a ball, which would normally be an inflated pig's bladder, and to get this ball to a designated goal. And sometimes these goals would be set miles apart, and matches could last for hours, and the action would spill through the streets, rivers, fields, and people would get battered, they'd get drenched, they'd get bruised. Injuries were very common. The game was so disruptive that local authorities did try to ban it, but it remained popular because it brought communities together, and it offered offered them a bit of fun, even if it was dangerous and people were getting carried off the field afterwards. It was fun to them. So that was mob football. Now another, if we go across to the Mediterranean and we go back to the ancient Egyptians, now they enjoyed a rather unusual sport, and it was tug of war, which you would have heard of, but it was with boats. So they would have two boats, they would be tied together on the Nile, and the teams would row furiously in opposite directions until one boat capsized. It would have been quite dramatic. You would have had the nobles and the labourers alike all gripping onto ropes and splashing in the river and just trying not to end up in the mud. That's what they did for fun, allegedly. So which do you think? What would you rather, get flattened in mob football or thrown in the Nile by a tug of war boat? Which
that's not much of a choice, is it?
No.
You know, you said about the mob football, local authorities tried to ban it.
Mm.
Oliver Cromwell banned it.
He banned everything. He was a miserable sod.
He wasn't a fan of fun, but it's mob football is the real one. And it would have been played between villages. Mm. And you might have just had to hit a post rather than a goal that we think of.
Yeah. And you wouldn't have had your teams of 11. Yeah. Is it 11 on it? I don't know nothing about football.
No, it was no. Obviously, modern football is teams of 11, but then it would have just been whoever wanted to join in.
Yeah, there were no set rules. So you're going with the mob football as the true story.
It's mob football, yeah.
Okay, yes, you are correct.
I know that one.
It was mob football. Villages really did play these chaotic hours-long games. Tug of war with boats, that was completely made up, but that would have been fun to watch, you have to admit.
Perhaps
it did happen, but we have no evidence that it happened.
More entertaining.
Yeah, but with the mob football, I mean, yeah, it sounds crazy, but you know, it would have been a release. It would have been fun. And I mean, you think about other medieval games that people that existed, you know, you had things like shin kicking and cudgel fighting and spear I mean, it's so violent. I mean, shin kicking, that just sounds like pathetic. That's like what kids do.
Yeah, they wrap their shins in hay.
Yeah.
Trying to kick people. I don't know how you work out who the winner is.
Probably the first or the last one to fall over, I imagine. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, how childish. But
obviously, things like spear throwing and archery would be handy when people were called up.
Yeah, I mean, those kind of make a little bit more sense. But I mean, if you were on the battlefield, are you you're going to kick somebody's shins to win? I tend to do it in football. Yeah, that's why they have to wear shin guards, because of people like you. But I mean, yeah, mob football, pretty intense. It sounds like when we used to play football as kids and we didn't kind of have any rules or anything, and
no, just chase after the ball, yeah.
Yeah, and just not know what the hell we were doing. We just used to, just kick the ball around and try and kick it at people. But apparently, I mean, it was quite violent, and some matches were so intense that some participants had to be carried home afterwards because they would just be...
There was deaths involved, yeah.
That would not surprise me. I can imagine as well there would have been a lot of damage to property and fines. Because the thing is, yeah,
there was no rules, so there was no referees to ruin it.
No, that's good. But okay, we're on the last story. You've done well. Let's see if you get this one.
I blagged it, yeah.
So, both these stories take part in 16th century, in the 16th century. So the first one is 16th century Germany. Now, we know that they, back in those days, they would actually put animals on trial. I already knew that. I'm sure you already knew that.
Yeah.
That's not news to you, or probably anyone that knows a little bit about history. But 16th century Germany, roosters were actually fined for crowing too early and disturbing the villagers' sleep. Now, obviously, roosters didn't have any money, so the owner supposedly would have to pay the penalty in beer to their neighbours. So that was actually a thing, or was it actually a thing? You don't know. But yes, when the rooster would crow, when the rooster crowed at a time that the villagers deemed too early, the owners of the birds would get a fine, and they would have to pay that fine in beer. So that was one. Now, the other one, this was also 16th century, but this time we're in France, and we have a mouse that was put on trial for eating grain in a bakery. Now, the court treated it like any other offender. They called witnesses. The mouse was actually assigned a lawyer to represent it. And the outcome, the mouse was found guilty and was sentenced to exile. And they released it into the countryside miles away from the town in an attempt to prevent further theft. So, yes, what do you think really happened? Do you think the rooster story is correct, or the mouse story, which sounds more believable to you? They both sound ridiculous to me.
Neither of them is found real whatsoever. I know there's some rats were tried somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember which country it was on. It was in, and whoever it was who was defending the rats They didn't turn up, funny enough. They never turned up for their trial. And the person who's defending them said it wouldn't be safe for them to come out during the daytime because cats would get them. So it was deemed all right for them not to turn up. But
so let them off.
A rooster for crowing.
You've got to pick one. You've got to pick one.
Yeah. I've, whichever one it is, I've never heard of it. I'm going to guess the mouse.
Do you think the mouse story is correct? A mouse being put on trial for eating grain.
For eating grain, yeah, I think, yeah, because obviously I know the rat one, I'm going to go with the mouse one.
Well, you're right. That is actually a true story, and there are court records to...
Ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. The rooster one actually sounds more believable in a strange way. Yes.
Both as ridiculous, but both as believable as yes. each other.
Yeah, that was kind of my aim. It was kind of like finding a true story that sounded ridiculous and then making up a story that sounded ridiculous but also believable.
Yeah.
It's been very hard. But yes, you are correct.
I'm sure in the past, in this country, we've probably called animals to court to give evidence against witches.
Yeah, well, they used to, sometimes they would try cats for witchcraft because the judges would debate whether the cat had signed the devil's book.
Yeah, of course.
I just made that up. That didn't actually happen. But what is true is in Switzerland, a rooster was once executed for laying an egg because people thought it was devil. It was the devil's work. And that's actually true. That's a rooster laid an egg. Clearly, the rooster had gender assignment issues.
It might have been,
because you know that wasn't unheard of, but back then people would have seen that as the devil's work. What was outwardly a male animal was laying an egg, so yeah, that happened. But the cat one, I just invented that, sorry about that. Couldn't resist. You brought it up, but yeah, so that is the end, and you have got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You've got 8 out of 10. Well done.
God, that's, as I said, they apologise for a fluke in snooker, so I apologise because I blagged most of those.
You did. I think a couple of them you knew, but yes, the ones that you guessed, actually guessed correctly, so well done.
I got lucky.
I would have struggled with that, to be fair. I was the one making up the other story, and I still couldn't remember what was the right... I had to write down notes, which was true, which was false. Because I thought, now, which one did I make up? But, yeah. So, well done. 8 out of 10. Not bad. Not bad.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's that. That's the end of the round. You did well. Congratulations. I hope you enjoyed that. I thought that would make it a little bit more fun.
Yeah. I quite enjoyed that.
Good.
Having to try and work, base things on what little I do know in certain areas.
But, yeah. Have to do one of them again. That was quite fun. I'm sure I can make up some more absolute nonsense. I'm quite good at doing that. I'll let you do the sign off bit.
That's very kind of you. So thank you for listening. You have been listening to the We're Not Experts History Podcast, which I don't know, 8 out of 10 suggests maybe we are experts, or one of us is anyway. But please remember,
it's not me.
I might have made that comment, but we really, really are not experts. Thank you for listening.